goods and make 2% more stuff. Or we could make the same amount of stuff with 2% fewer inputs. One of the most interesting debates in economics is whether or not the American economy has undergone a sharp increase in the rate of productivity growth. Some economists, including Alan Greenspan during his tenure as Fed chairman, have argued that investments in information technology have led to permanently higher rates of productivity growth. Others, such as Robert Gordon at Northwestern University, believe that productivity growth has not changed significantly when one interprets the data properly. The answer to that debate matters enormously. From 1947 to 1975, productivity grew at an annual rate of 2.7% a year. From 1975 until the mid-1990s, for reasons that are still not fully understood, productivity growth slowed to 1.4% a year. Then it got better again, from 2000 to 2008. Productivity growth returned to a much healthier 2.5% annually. That may seem like a trivial difference. In fact, it has a profound effect on our standard of living. One handy trick in finance and economics is the rule of 72. Divide 72 by a rate of growth, or a rate of interest, and the answer will tell you roughly how long it will take for a growing quantity to double. For example, the principal in a bank account paying 4% interest will double in roughly 18 years. When productivity grows at 2.7% a year, our standard of living doubles every 27 years. At 1.4%, it doubles every 51 years. Productivity growth makes us richer, regardless of what's going on in the rest of the world. If productivity grows at 4% in Japan and 2% in the United States, then both countries are getting richer. To understand why, go back to our simple farm economy. If one farmer is raising 2% more corn and hogs every year, and his neighbor is raising 4% more, then they're eating more every year, or trading more away. If this disparity goes on for a long time, one of them will become significantly richer than the other, which may become a source of envy or political friction, but they are both growing steadily better off. The important point is that productivity growth, like so much else in economics, is not a zero-sum game. What would be the effect in America if 500 million people in India became more productive and gradually moved from poverty to the middle class? We'd become richer, too. Poor villagers, currently subsisting on $1 a day, cannot afford to buy our software, our cars, our music, our books, our agricultural exports. If they were wealthier, they could. Meanwhile, some of those 500 million people, whose potential is currently wasted for lack of education, would produce goods and services that are superior to what we have now, making us better off. One of those newly educated peasants might be the person who discovers an AIDS vaccine or a process for reversing global warming. To paraphrase the United Negro College Fund, 500 million minds are a terrible thing to waste. Productivity growth depends on investment in physical capital, in human capital, in research and development, and even in things like more effective government institutions. These investments require that we give up consumption in the present in order to be able to consume more in the future. If you skip buying a BMW and invest in a college education instead, your future income will be higher. Similarly, a software company may forego paying its shareholders a dividend and plow its profits back into the development of a new, better product. The government may collect taxes, depriving us of some current consumption, to fund research in genetics that improves our health in the future. In each case, we spend resources now so that we'll become more productive later. When we turn to the macroeconomy, our study of the economy as a whole, one important concern will be whether or not we're investing enough as a nation to continue growing our standard of living. Our legal, regulatory, and tax structures also affect productivity growth. High taxes, bad government, poorly defined property rights, or excessive regulation can diminish or eliminate the incentive to make productive investments. Collective farms, for example, are a very bad way to organize agriculture. Social factors, such as discrimination, can profoundly affect productivity. A society that does not educate its women, or that denies opportunities to members of a particular race or caste or tribe, is leaving a vast resource fallow. Productivity growth also depends a great deal on innovation and technological progress, neither of which is understood perfectly. Why did the Internet explode onto the scene in the mid-1990s rather than the late 1970s? How is it that we've cracked the human genome, yet we still don't have a cheap source of clean energy? In short, fostering productivity growth is like raising children. We know what kinds of things are important, even if there is no blueprint for raising an Olympic athlete or a Harvard scholar. The study of human capital has profound implications for public policy. Most important, it can tell us why we haven't all starved to death. The Earth's population has grown to 6 billion. How have we been able to feed so many mouths? In the 18th century, Thomas Malthus famously predicted a dim future for humankind because he believed that, as society grew richer, it would continuously squander those gains through population growth, having more children. These additional mouths would gobble up the surplus. In his view, humankind was destined to live on the brink of subsistence, recklessly procreating during the good times and then starving during the bad. As Paul Krugman has pointed out, for 55 of the last 57 centuries, Malthus was right. The world population grew, but the human condition did not change significantly. Only with the advent of the Industrial Revolution did people begin to grow steadily richer. Even then, Malthus was not far off the mark. As Gary Becker points out, parents did spend more on children when their incomes rose, as Malthus predicted, but they spent a lot more on each child and had fewer children, as human capital theory predicts. The economic transformations of the Industrial Revolution, namely the large productivity gains, made parents' time more expensive. As the advantages of having more children declined, people began investing their rising incomes in the quality of their children, not merely the quantity. One of the fallacies of poverty is that developing countries are poor because they have rapid population growth. In fact, the causal relationship is best understood going the other direction. Poor people have many children because the cost of bearing and raising children is low. Birth control, no matter how dependable, works only to the extent that families prefer fewer children. As a result, one of the most potent weapons for fighting population growth is creating better economic opportunities for women, which starts by educating girls. Taiwan doubled the number of girls graduating from high school between 1966 and 1975. Meanwhile, the fertility rate dropped by half. In the developed world, where women have enjoyed an extraordinary range of new economic opportunities for more than half a century, fertility rates have fallen near or below replacement level, which is 2.1 births per woman. We began this chapter with a discussion of Bill Gates' home, which is, I am fairly certain, bigger than yours. At the dawn of the third millennium, America is a profoundly unequal place. Is the nation growing more unequal? The answer, by almost any measure, is yes. According to analysis by the Congressional Budget Office, American households in the bottom fifth of the income distribution were earning only 2% more in 2004, adjusted for inflation, than they were in 1979. That's a quarter century with no real income growth at all. Americans in the middle of the income distribution did better over the same stretch. Their average household income grew 15% in real terms. Those in the top quintile, The top 20% saw household income growth of 63% adjusted for inflation. As America's longest economic boom in history unfolded, the rich got richer while the poor ran in place or even got poorer. Wages for male high school dropouts have fallen by roughly a quarter compared to what their dads earned if they were also high school dropouts. The recession that began in 2007 has narrowed the gap between America's rich and poor slightly by destroying wealth at the top, not by making the typical worker better off. Most economists would agree that the long-term trend is a growing gap between America's rich and poor. The most stunning action has been at the top of the top. In 1979, the wealthiest 1% of Americans earned 9% of the nation's total income. Now, they get 16% of America's annual collective paycheck. Why? Human capital offers the most insight into this social phenomena. The last several decades have been a real-life version of Revenge of the Nerds. Skilled workers in America have always earned higher wages than unskilled workers. That difference has started to grow at a remarkable rate. In short, human capital has become more important and therefore better rewarded than ever before. One simple measure of the importance of human capital is the gap between the wages paid to high school graduates and the wages paid to college graduates. College graduates earned an average of 40% more than high school graduates at the beginning of the 1980s. Now they earn 80% more. Individuals with graduate degrees do even better than that. The 21st century is an especially good time to be a rocket scientist. Our economy is evolving in ways that favor skilled workers. For example, the shift toward computers in nearly every industry favors workers who either have computer skills or are smart enough to learn them on the job. Technology makes smart workers more productive while making low-skilled workers redundant. ATMs replaced bank tellers. Self-serve pumps replaced gas station attendants. Automated assembly lines replaced workers doing mindless, repetitive tasks. Indeed, the assembly line at General Motors encapsulates the major trend in the American economy. Computers and sophisticated robots now assemble the major components of a car, which creates high-paying jobs for people who write software and design robots while reducing the demand for workers with no specialized skills other than a willingness to do an honest day's work. Meanwhile, international trade puts low-skilled workers in greater competition with other low-skilled workers around the globe. In the long run, international trade is a powerful force for good. In the short run, it has victims. Trade, like technology, makes high-skilled workers better off because it provides new markets for our high-tech exports. Boeing sells aircraft to India. Microsoft sells software to Europe. McKinsey & Company sells consulting services to Latin America. Again, this is more good news for people who know how to design a fuel-efficient jet engine or explain total quality management in Spanish. On the other hand, it puts our low-tech workers in competition with low-priced laborers in Vietnam. Nike can pay workers $1 a day to make shoes in a Vietnamese sweatshop. You can't make Boeing airplanes that way. Globalization creates more opportunities for skilled workers. Naked Economics is published in 11 languages, and more competition for unskilled workers. There's still disagreement about the degree to which different causes are responsible for the shifting gap in wages. Unions have grown less powerful, giving blue-collar workers less clout at the bargaining table. Meanwhile, high-wage workers are logging more hours on the job than their low-wage counterparts, which exacerbates the total earnings gap. More and more industries are linking pay to performance, which increases wage gaps between those who are more and less productive. In any case, the rise in income inequality is real. Should we care? Economists have traditionally argued that we should not, for two basic reasons. First, Income inequality sends important signals in the economy. The growing wage gap between high school and college graduates, for example, will motivate many students to get college degrees. Similarly, the spectacular wealth earned by entrepreneurs provides an incentive to take the risks necessary for leaps in innovation, many of which have huge payoffs for society. Economics is about incentives, and the prospect of getting rich is a big incentive. Second, many economists argue that we should not care about the gap between rich and poor as long as everybody is living better. In other words, we should care about how much pie the poor are getting, not how much pie they're getting relative to Bill Gates. In his 1999 presidential address to the American Economics Association, Robert Fogel, a Nobel Prize-winning economic historian, pointed out that our poorest citizens have amenities unknown even to royalty 100 years ago. More than 90% of public housing residents have a color television, for example. Envy may be one of the 7 deadly sins, but it's not something to which economists have traditionally paid much attention. My utility should depend on how much I like my car, not on whether or not my neighbor is driving a Jaguar. Of course, common sense suggests otherwise. H.L. Mencken once noted that a wealthy man is a man who earns $100 a year more than his wife's sister's husband. Some economists have belatedly begun to believe that he was onto something. David Newmark and Andrew Postlethwaite looked at a large sample of American sisters in an effort to understand why some women choose to work outside of the home and others do not. When the researchers controlled for all the usual explanations, unemployment in the local labor market, a woman's education and work experience, etc., they found powerful evidence to support H.L. Mencken's wry observation. A woman in their sample was significantly more likely to seek paid employment if her sister's husband earned more than her own. Cornell economist Robert Frank, author of Luxury Fever, has made a persuasive case that relative wealth, the size of my pie compared to my neighbor's, is an important determinant of our utility. He offered survey respondents a choice between two worlds. A. You can earn $110,000 and everyone else earns $200,000. Or B. You earn $100,000 and everyone else earns $85,000. As he explains, the income figures represent real purchasing power. Your income in World A would command a house 10% larger than the one you could afford in World B, 10% more restaurant dinners, and so on. By choosing World B, you'd give up a small amount of absolute income in return for a large increase in relative income. You'd be richer in World A, you'd be less wealthy in World B, but richer than everyone else. Which scenario would make you happier? Mr. Frank found that a majority of Americans would choose B. In other words, relative income does matter. Envy may be part of the explanation. It's also true, Mr. Frank points out, that in complex social environments, we seek ways to evaluate our performance. Relative wealth is one of them. There's a second, more pragmatic concern about rising income inequality. Might the gap between rich and poor, ethics aside, become large enough that it begins to inhibit economic growth? Is there a point at which income inequality stops motivating us to work harder and becomes counterproductive? This might happen for all kinds of reasons. The poor might become disenfranchised to the point that they reject important political and economic institutions, such as property rights or the rule of law. A lopsided distribution of income may cause the rich to squander resources or increasingly frivolous luxuries, for example, doggy birthday cakes, when other kinds of investments, such as human capital for the poor, would yield a higher return. Or class warfare may lead to measures that punish the rich without making the poor any better off. Some studies have indeed found a negative relationship between income inequality and economic growth. Others have found just the opposite. Over time, data will inform this relationship. But the larger philosophical debate will rage on. If the pie is growing, how much should we care about the size of the pieces? The subject of human capital begs some final questions. Will the poor always be with us, as Jesus once admonished? Does our free market system make poverty inevitable? Must there be losers if there are huge economic winners? No, no, and no. Economic development is not a zero-sum game. The world does not need poor countries in order to have rich countries, nor must some people be poor in order for others to be rich. Families who live in public housing on the south side of Chicago are not poor because Bill Gates lives in a big house. They are poor despite the fact that Bill Gates lives in a big house. For a complex array of reasons, America's poor have not shared in the productivity gains spawned by Microsoft Windows. Bill Gates did not take their pie away. He did not stand in the way of their success or benefit from their misfortunes. Rather, his vision and talent created an enormous amount of wealth that not everybody got to share. There's a crucial distinction between a world in which Bill Gates gets rich by stealing other people's crops and a world in which he gets rich by growing his own enormous food supply that he shares with some people and not others. The latter is a better representation of how a modern economy works. In theory, a world in which every individual was educated, healthy, and productive would be a world in which every person lived comfortably. Perhaps we'll never cure the world of the assorted physical and mental illnesses that prevent some individuals from reaching their full potential. But that's biology, not economics. Economics tells us that there is no theoretical limit to how well we can live or how widely our wealth can be spread. Can that really be true? If we all had PhDs, who would pass out the towels at the Four Seasons? Probably no one. As a population becomes more productive, we begin to substitute technology for labor. We use voicemail instead of secretaries, washing machines instead of maids, ATMs instead of bank tellers, databases instead of file clerks, vending machines instead of shopkeepers, backhoes instead of ditch diggers. The motivation for this development harks back to a concept from Chapter 1, opportunity cost. Highly skilled individuals can do all kinds of productive things with their time. Thus, it's fabulously expensive to hire an engineer to bag groceries. How much would you have to be paid to pass out towels at the Four Seasons? There are far fewer domestic servants in the United States than in India, even though the United States is a richer country. India is awash with low-skilled workers who have few other employment options. America is not, making domestic labor relatively expensive, as anyone with a nanny can attest. Who can afford a butler who'd otherwise earn $50 an hour writing computer code? When we cannot automate menial tasks, we may relegate them to students and young people as a means for them to acquire human capital. I caddied for more than a decade, most famously for George W. Bush, long before he ascended to the presidency. My wife waited tables. These jobs provide work experience, which is an important component of human capital. But suppose there was some unpleasant task that could not be automated away, nor could it be done safely by young people at the beginning of their careers. Imagine, for example, a highly educated community that produces all kinds of valuable goods and services, but generates a disgusting sludge as a byproduct. Further imagine that collecting the sludge is horrible, mind-numbing work. Yet, if the sludge is not collected, then the whole economy will grind to a halt. If everyone has a Harvard degree, who hauls away the sludge? The sludge hauler does. And he or she, incidentally, would be one of the best paid workers in town. If the economy depends on hauling this stuff away and no machine can do the task, then the community would have to induce someone to do the work. The way to induce people to do anything is to pay them a lot. The wage for hauling sludge would get bid up to the point that some individual, a doctor or an engineer or a writer, would be willing to leave a more pleasant job to haul sludge. Thus, a world rich in human capital may still have unpleasant tasks. Proctologist springs to mind, but no one has to be poor. Conversely, many people may accept less money to do particularly enjoyable work. Teaching college students comes to mind, especially with the summer off. Human capital creates opportunities. It makes us richer and healthier. It makes us more complete human beings. It enables us to live better while working less. Most important, from a public policy perspective, human capital separates the haves from the have-nots. Marvin Zonis, a professor at the University of Chicago Graduate School of Business and a consultant to businesses and governments around the world, made this point wonderfully in a speech to the Chicago business community. Complexity will be the hallmark of our age, he noted. The demand everywhere will be for ever higher levels of human capital. The countries that get that right, the companies that understand how to mobilize and apply that human capital, and the schools that produce it, will be the big winners of our age. For the rest, more backwardness and more misery for their own citizens and more problems for the rest of us. Chapter 7. Financial Markets. What economics can tell us about getting rich quick and losing weight, too. When I was an undergraduate many years ago, a new diet swept through one of the sororities on campus. This was no ordinary diet. It was the grapefruit and ice cream diet. The premise, as the name would suggest, was that one could lose weight by eating large amounts of grapefruit and ice cream. The diet didn't work, of course, but the incident has always stuck with me. I was fascinated that a very smart group of women had tossed aside common sense to embrace a diet that could not possibly work. No medical or dietary information suggested that eating grapefruit and ice cream would cause weight loss. Still, it was an appealing thought. Who wouldn't want to lose weight by eating ice cream? I was reminded of the grapefruit and ice cream diet recently, when one of my neighbors began to share his investment strategy. He'd taken a big hit over the past year because his portfolio was laden with internet and tech stocks, he explained, but he was plunging back into the market with a new and improved strategy. He was studying the charts of past market movements for shapes that would signal where the market was going next. I cannot remember the specific shapes he was looking for. I was distracted at the time, both because I was watering flowers and because my mind was screaming, "Grapefruit and ice cream!" My smart neighbor, who's both a doctor and a university faculty member, was venturing far from the halls of science with his investment strategy, and that is the broader lesson. When it comes to personal finance and losing weight, intelligent people will toss good sense aside faster than you can say miracle diet. The rules for investing successfully are strikingly simple, but they require discipline and short-term sacrifice. The payoff is a slow, steady accumulation of wealth, with plenty of setbacks along the way, rather than a quick windfall. So, faced with the prospect of giving up consumption in the present for plotting success in the future, we eagerly embrace faster, easier methods, and are then shocked when they don't work. This chapter is not a primer on personal finance. There are some excellent books on investment strategies. Burton Malkiel, who was kind enough to write the foreword for this book, has written one of the best, A Random Walk Down Wall Street. Rather, this chapter is about what a basic understanding of markets, the ideas covered in the first two chapters, can tell us about personal investing. Any investment strategy must obey the basic laws of economics, just as any diet is constrained by the realities of chemistry, biology, and physics. To borrow the title of Wally Lamb's best-selling novel, I know this much is true. At first glance, the financial markets are remarkably complex. Stocks and bonds are complicated enough, but then there are options, futures, options on futures, interest rate swaps, government strips, and the now infamous credit default swaps. At the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, it's now possible to buy or sell a futures contract based on the average temperature in Los Angeles. At the Chicago Board of Trade, one can buy and sell the right to emit SO2. Yes, it's actually possible to make or lose money by trading smog. The details of these contracts can be mind-numbing. Yet, at bottom, most of what's going on is fairly straightforward. Financial instruments, like every other good or service in a market economy, must create some value. Both the buyer and the seller must perceive themselves as better off by entering into the deal. All the while, entrepreneurs seek to introduce financial products that are cheaper, faster, easier, or otherwise better than what already exists. Mutual funds were a financial innovation. So were the index funds that Burt Malkiel helped to make popular. At the height of the financial crisis in 2008, it became clear that even Wall Street executives did not fully understand some of the products that their firms were buying and selling. Still, all financial instruments, no matter how complex the bells and whistles, are based on four simple needs. Raising capital. One of the fascinating things in life, particularly in America, is that we can spend large sums of money that don't belong to us. Financial markets enable us to borrow money. Sometimes this means that Visa and MasterCard indulge our eagerness to consume today what we cannot afford until next year, if then. More often, and more significant to the economy, borrowing makes possible all kinds of investment. We borrow to pay college tuition. We borrow to buy homes. We borrow to build plants and equipment or to launch new businesses. We borrow to do things that make us better off even after we've paid the cost of borrowing. Sometimes we raise capital without borrowing. We may sell shares of our business to the public. Thus we trade an ownership stake, and therefore a claim on future profits, in exchange for cash. Or companies and governments may borrow directly from the public by issuing bonds. These transactions may be as simple as a new car loan or as complex as a multi-billion-dollar bailout by the International Monetary Fund. The bottom line never changes. Individuals, firms, and governments need capital to do things today that they could not otherwise afford. The financial markets provide it to them at a price. Modern economies cannot survive without credit. Indeed, the international development community has begun to realize that making credit available to entrepreneurs in the developing world, even loans as small as $50 or $100, can be a powerful tool for fighting poverty. Opportunity International is one such microcredit lender. In 2000, the organization made nearly 325,000 low-collateral or non-collateral loans in 24 developing countries. The average loan size was a seemingly paltry $195. Esther Gilabuzi, a widow in Uganda with six children, represents a typical story. She's a professional midwife, and she used a tiny loan by Western standards to set up a clinic, still without electricity. She since delivered some 1,400 babies, charging patients from $6 to $14 each. Opportunity International claims to have created some 430,000 jobs. As impressive, the repayment rate on the microloans is 96%. Storing, protecting, and making profitable use of excess capital. The Sultan of Brunei earned billions of dollars in oil revenues in the 1970s. Suppose he'd stuffed that cash under his mattress and left it there. He would have had several problems. First, it's very difficult to sleep with billions of dollars stuffed under the mattress. Second, with billions of dollars stuffed under the mattress, the dirty linens would not be the only thing that disappeared every morning. Nimble fingers, not to mention sophisticated criminals, would find their way to the stash. Third and most important, the most ruthless and efficient thief would be inflation. If the Sultan of Brunei stuffed $1 billion under his mattress in 1970, it would be worth only $180 million today. Thus, the Sultan's first concern would be protecting his wealth, both from theft and from inflation, each of which diminishes his purchasing power in its own way. His second concern would be putting his excess capital to some productive use. The world is full of prospective borrowers, all of whom are willing to pay for the privilege. When economists slap fancy equations on the chalkboard, the symbol for the interest rate is R, not I. Why? Because the interest rate is considered to be the rental rate, R, on capital. And that is the most intuitive way to think about what is going on. Individuals, companies, and institutions with surplus capital are renting it to others who can make more productive use of it. The Harvard University endowment is roughly $25 billion. This is the Ivy League equivalent of rainy day money. Stuffing it under the mattresses of students and faculty would be both impractical and a waste of tremendous resource. Instead, Harvard employs nearly 200 professionals to manage this hoard in a way that generates a healthy return for the university while providing capital to the rest of the world. Harvard buys stocks and bonds, invests in venture capital funds, and otherwise puts $25 billion in the hands of people and institutions around the globe who can do productive things with it. From 1995 to 2005, the endowment earned an average 16% annual return, which is a lot more productive for the university than leaving the cash lying around campus. Harvard also managed to lose 30% of its endowment during the financial crisis, so we'll come back to the Harvard endowment when we talk about risk and reward. Financial markets do more than take capital from the rich and lend it to everyone else. They enable each of us to smooth consumption over our lifetimes, which is a fancy way of saying that we don't have to spend income at the same time we earn it. Shakespeare may have admonished us to be neither borrowers nor lenders. The fact is that most of us will be both at some point. If we lived in an agrarian society, we'd have to eat our crops reasonably soon after the harvest or find some way to store them. Financial markets are a more sophisticated way of managing the harvest. We can spend income now that we have not yet earned, as by borrowing for college or a home. Or we can earn income now and spend it later, as by saving for retirement. The important point is that earning income has been divorced from spending it, allowing us much more flexibility in life. Insuring against risk. Life is a risky proposition. We risk death just getting into the bathtub, not to mention commuting to work or bungee jumping with friends. Let's consider some of the ways you might face financial ruin. Natural disaster, illness or disability, fraud or theft. One of our primary impulses as human beings is to minimize these risks. Financial markets help us to do that. The most obvious examples are health, life, and auto insurance. As we noted in Chapter 4, insurance companies charge more for your policy than they expect to pay out to you, on average. But average is a really important term here. You're not worried about average outcomes. You're worried about the worst things that could possibly happen to you. A bad draw. The tree that falls in an electrical storm and crushes your home could be devastating. Thus, most of us are willing to pay a predictable amount, even one that's more than we expect to get back, in order to protect ourselves against the unpredictable. Almost anything can be insured. Are you worried about pirates? You should be, if you ship goods through the South China Sea or the Malacca Strait. As The Economist explains, pirates still prey on ships and sailors, and far from being jolly sorts with wooden legs and eye patches, Today's pirates are nasty fellows with rocket-propelled grenades and speedboats. There were 266 acts of piracy, or attempts, reported to the International Maritime Organization in 2005. This is why firms sending cargo through dangerous areas buy marine insurance, which also protects against other risks at sea. When the French oil tanker Limburg was rammed by a suicide bomber in a speedboat packed with explosives off the coast of Yemen in 2002, the insurance company ended up writing a check for $70 million. Just like when someone backs into your car in the Safeway parking lot, only a much bigger claim. The clothing and shoe company Fila should have bought insurance before the 2009 U.S. Open tennis tournament, but didn't. Like other such companies, Fila endorses athletes and pays them large bonuses when they do great things. Fila endorses Belgian tennis player Kim Clijsters, winner of the U.S. Open, but opted not to buy win insurance for the roughly $300,000 in bonus money they had promised her for a victory. This was an expensive decision, but perhaps also an insulting one for Miss Clijsters. The insurance would have been cheap. Clijsters was unseeded, had played only two tournaments since leaving the game to have a baby, and was considered a 40-to-1 long shot by bookies before the tournament. The financial markets provide an array of other products that look complicated, but basically function like an insurance policy. A futures contract, for example, locks in a sale price for a commodity, anything from electrical power to soybean meal, at some defined date in the future. On the floor of the Board of Trade, one trader can agree to sell another trader 1,000 bushels of corn for $3.27 a bushel in March of 2010. What's the point? The point is that producers and consumers of these commodities have much to fear from future price swings. Corn farmers can benefit from locking in a sale price while their corn is still in the ground, or even before they plant it. Might the farmers get a better price by waiting to sell the crop until harvest? Absolutely. Or they might get a much lower price, leaving them without enough money to pay the bills. They, like the rest of us, are willing to pay a price for certainty. Meanwhile, big purchasers of commodities can benefit from being on the other side of the trade. Airlines use futures contracts to lock in a predictable price for jet fuel. Fast food restaurants can enter into futures contracts for ground beef, pork bellies, most of which are made into bacon, and even cheddar cheese. I don't know any Starbucks executives personally, but I have a pretty good idea what keeps them awake at night: the world price of coffee beans. Americans will pay $3.50 for a grande skim decaf latte, but probably not $6.50, which is why I'd be willing to bet the royalties from this book that Starbucks uses the financial markets to protect itself from sudden swings in the price of coffee. Other products deal with other risks. Consider one of my personal favorites, catastrophe bonds. Wall Street dreamed up these gems to help insurance companies hedge their natural disaster risk. Remember, the insurance company writes a check when a tree falls on your house. If a lot of trees fall on a lot of houses, then the company, or even the entire industry, has a problem. Insurance companies can minimize that risk by issuing catastrophe bonds. These bonds pay a significantly higher rate of interest than other corporate bonds, because there's a twist. If hurricanes or earthquakes do serious damage to a certain area during a specified period of time, then the investors forfeit some or all of their principal. The United Services Automobile Association did one of the first deals in the late 1990s tied to the hurricane season on the East Coast. If a single hurricane caused $1.5 billion in claims or more, then the catastrophe bond investors lost all of their principal. The insurance company, on the other hand, was able to offset its claims losses by avoiding repayment on its debt. If a hurricane did between $1 billion and $1.5 billion in damage, then investors lost a fraction of their principal. If hurricanes did relatively little damage that year, then the bondholders got their principal back, plus nearly 12% in interest. A very nice return for a bond. The same basic idea is now being used to protect against terrorism. The World Football Federation, which governs international soccer, ensured the 2006 World Cup against disruption due to terrorism and other risks by issuing $260 million in cancellation bonds. If the tournament went off without a hitch, as it did, the investors get their capital back, along with a handsome profit. If there had been a disruption serious enough to cancel the World Cup, the investors lose some or all of their money, which is used instead to compensate the World Football Federation for the lost revenue. The beauty of these products lies in the way they spread risk. The party selling the bonds avoids ruin by sharing the costs of a natural disaster or a terrorist attack with a broad group of investors, each of whom has a diversified portfolio and will therefore take a relatively small hit even if something truly awful happens. Indeed, one role of the financial markets is to allow us to spread our eggs around generously. I must recount one of those inane experiences that can happen only in high school. Some expert in adolescent behavior at my high school decided that students would be less likely to become teen parents if they realized how much responsibility it required. The best way to replicate parenthood, the experts reckoned, would be to have each student carry an egg around school. The egg represented a baby and was to be treated as such, handled delicately, never left out of sight, and so on. But this was high school. Eggs were dropped, crushed, left in gym lockers, hurled against the wall by bullies, exposed to secondhand smoke in the bathrooms, etc. The experience taught me nothing about parenthood. It did convince me forever that carrying eggs is a risky proposition. The financial markets make it cheap and easy to put our eggs into many different baskets. With a $1,000 investment in a mutual fund, you can invest in 500 or more companies. If you are forced to buy individual stocks from a broker, you could never afford so much diversity with a mere $1,000. For $10,000, you can diversify across a wide range of assets: big stocks, small stocks, international stocks, long-term bonds, short-term bonds, junk bonds, real estate. Some of those assets will perform well at the same time others are doing poorly, protecting you from Wall Street's equivalent of bullies hurling eggs against the wall. One attraction of catastrophe bonds for investors is that their payout is determined by the frequency of natural disasters, which is not correlated with the performance of stocks, bonds, real estate, or other traditional investments. Even the much maligned credit default swaps have a legitimate investment purpose. A credit default swap is really just an insurance policy on whether or not some third party will pay back its debts. Suppose your husband pressures you to loan $25,000 to your ne'er-do-well brother-in-law so that he can finally complete his court-mandated anger management program and turn his life around. You have grave concerns about whether you'll ever see any of this money again. What you need is a credit default swap. You can pay some other party, presumably with a more favorable view of your brother-in-law's creditworthiness, to enter into a contract with you that promises to pay you $25,000 in the event that your brother-in-law does not pay back the cash. The contract functions as insurance against default. Like any other kind of insurance, you pay for this protection. If your brother-in-law gets his act together and pays back the loan, you'll have purchased the credit default swap for nothing, which is how the other party to the transaction, or the counterparty, makes its money. How could something so simple and seemingly useful contribute to the near collapse of the global financial system? Read on. Speculation. Of course, once any financial product is created, it fulfills another basic human need, the urge to speculate, or bet on short-term price movements. One can use the futures market to mitigate risk, or one can use the futures market to bet on the price of soybeans next year. One can use the bond market to raise capital, or one can use it to bet on whether or not Ben Bernanke will cut interest rates next month. One can use the stock market to invest in companies and share their future profits. Or one can buy a stock at 10 a.m. in hopes of making a few bucks by noon. Financial products are to speculation what sporting events are to gambling. They facilitate it, even if that's not their primary purpose. This is what went wrong with credit default swaps. The curious thing about these contracts is that anyone can get into the action, regardless of whether or not they're a party to the debt that's being guaranteed. Let's stick with the example of your loser brother-in-law. It makes sense for you to use a credit default swap to protect yourself against loss. However, that same market also allows the rest of us to bet on whether or not your brother-in-law will pay back the loan. That's not hedging a bet. That's speculation. So for any single debt, there may be hundreds or thousands of contracts tied to whether or not it gets repaid. Think about what that means if your brother-in-law starts skipping his anger management classes and defaults. At that point, a $25,000 loss gets magnified thousands of times over. If the parties guaranteeing that debt haven't done their homework, so they don't truly understand what a loser your brother-in-law is, or if they don't care, because they earn big bonuses for making dubious bets with the firm's capital, then an otherwise small set of economic setbacks can explode into something bigger. That's what happened when the American economy hit a real estate-related speed bump in 2007. AIG was the firm at the heart of the credit default debacle because it guaranteed a lot of debt that went bad. In his excellent 2009 assessment of the financial crisis, former chief economist for the International Monetary Fund, Simon Johnson, writes, "Regulators, legislators, and academics almost all assumed that the managers of these banks knew what they were doing. In retrospect, they didn't. AIG's financial products division, for instance, made $2.5 million in pre-tax profits in 2005, largely by selling underpriced insurance on complex, poorly understood securities. Often described as picking up nickels in front of a steamroller, this strategy is profitable in ordinary years and catastrophic in bad ones. As of last fall, AIG had outstanding insurance on more than $400 billion in securities. To date, the U.S. government, in an effort to rescue the company, has committed to about $180 billion in investments and loans to cover losses that AIG's sophisticated risk modeling had said were virtually impossible." Raising capital, protecting capital, hedging risk, speculating. That's it. All the frantic activity on Wall Street or LaSalle Street, home of the Futures Exchange in Chicago, fits into one or more of those buckets. The world of high finance is often described as a rich man's version of Las Vegas. Risk, glamour, interesting personalities, and lots of money changing hands. Yet the analogy is terribly inappropriate. Everything that happens in Las Vegas is a zero-sum game. If the house wins a hand of blackjack, you lose. And the odds are stacked heavily in favor of the house. If you play blackjack long enough, at least without counting cards, it's a mathematical certainty that you will go broke. Las Vegas provides entertainment, but it does not serve any broader social purpose. Wall Street does. Most of what happens is a positive-sum game. Things get built. Companies are launched. Individuals and companies manage risk that might otherwise be devastating. Not every transaction is a winner, of course. Just as individuals make investments they later regret, the capital markets are perfectly capable of squandering huge amounts of capital. Choose your favorite failed.com and think of that as an example. Billions of dollars of capital flowed into businesses that didn't work. The real estate bubble and the Wall Street meltdown did the same on an even bigger scale. Adam Smith's invisible hand has hurled a lot of capital into the ocean, never to be seen again. Meanwhile, some potentially profitable enterprises are starved for capital because they have insufficient collateral. Economists worry, for example, that too little credit is available for poor families who'd like to invest in human capital. A college degree is an excellent investment, but it's not something that can be repossessed in the event of default. Still, the financial markets do for capital what other markets do for everything else: allocate it in a highly productive, albeit imperfect, way. Capital flows to where it can earn the highest return, which is not a bad place to have it flowing, as opposed to, say, into businesses run by top communist officials or friends of the king. As with the rest of the economy, government can be enemy or friend. Government can mess up the capital markets in the same way as it can mess up anything else, with overly burdensome taxes and regulations, by diverting capital into pet projects, by refusing to allow creative destruction to work its harshly efficient ways. Or government can make the financial markets work better, by minimizing fraud, forcing transparency on the system, creating and enforcing a regulatory framework, providing public goods that lower the cost of doing business, and so on. Once again, the wisdom lies in telling the difference. Obviously, the current crisis has presented some teachable moments. The financial regulatory system needs to be patched up, if not completely overhauled. The challenge will be to protect what a modern financial system does best: allocating capital to productive investments and protecting us from risks we can't afford. While curtailing the excesses, stupid bets that enrich the folks making them before eventually leaving a mess for the rest of us to clean up. All that is well and good, but how does one get rich in the markets? One of my former colleagues, The Economist, suggested that this book should be called Are You Rich Enough? His logic was that most people would answer no and rip the book off the shelves. Sadly, I'm not a big believer in surefire strategies to trade your way to riches. Just as miracle weight loss programs violate nearly everything we know about health and nutrition, get-rich-quick schemes violate the most basic principles of economics. Let me begin with an example. Suppose you're shopping for a home in the Lincoln Park neighborhood of Chicago. After many weeks of searching, you find that a 3-story single-family brownstone will cost you somewhere in the range of $500,000. Some homes are listed for $450,000, but they need work. Others are listed for $600,000 because they have extra amenities. Just when you begin to despair that you'll have to spend $500,000 for a home, you find a brownstone listed for $250,000 that meets all of your specifications. When you investigate, you learn that this home is every bit as nice as the ones you've been looking at. Same location, same size, same structural integrity. Still wary, you ask your real estate agent for her assessment. She assures you that this house is indeed a remarkable bargain and should be selling for $500,000. In her professional opinion, there's no doubt that you could buy this house for $250,000 and sell it only months later for $500,000 or more. Then you see the final piece of evidence. An article on page 3 of Crain's Chicago Business has a screaming headline: Bargain of the Month: Lincoln Park Brownstone Listed for $250,000. So you snap up the house for $250,000. Sure enough, 6 months later, you sell it for $500,000, doubling your money. Your actual return would be much higher, since much of the purchase would be financed. If you put $50,000 down, for example, you would have earned $250,000 on a $50,000 investment, minus the interest you paid to carry the mortgage during the period you own the house. How many things are wrong with this story? Quite a few. A reasonable person might begin by asking some of the following questions. 1. If this house was really worth $500,000, who was the moron selling it for $250,000? Was this person not willing or able to do the 3 minutes of work necessary to determine that comparable houses in the neighborhood were selling for twice as much? If not, wasn't there a family member or a real estate agent whose commission is based on the sale price willing to point out this enormous discrepancy? 2. Maybe not. In that case, why hasn't my real estate agent bought this house for herself? If this house is a sure thing,